So this is the fourth full day of our 7-day retreat here in the Southern Dharma. Fourth day is a kind of a critical juncture in the flow of a retreat. First few days of kind of getting grounded, being here, getting used to the routine, the schedule, sleeping arrangements, practice. Hopefully behind us. And from listening to you and talking to you, I know that for most of you, your practice is quote-unquote deepening. So this is a critical juncture. It's sort of like having climbed the first plateau. One might want to just say, well, that's quite an effort I made, right? And now I can just relax. But this is not the profound relaxation of practice. This is the kind of relaxation which allows the habit, the habitual habits of the mind, to return. And we might find ourselves not so vigilantly guarding the boundaries. In the Paramitas, there is that vigilant introspection. Vigilance. Energetic practice, joyful effort. Now, the reason that so many of us, our practice is so stop, start, back, forth, is because we never really get the energy, the kind of energy that is needed to really take our awareness, take our practice to a new level. In these very ideal environment that we are in, both the external environment of this natural setting, the beauty of this natural setting, the peace, stillness of this natural setting, you can see. We don't have to do much. We can just open ourselves to this, right? And it's quite capable of finding a deep sense of peace and relaxation. All we need to do is just be present to the natural environment, right? And then with the support of the Southern Dharma staff, we have very little responsibilities to take care of. But if we think that that's all that this practice is about, then why doesn't Vimalakirti just say? Right? I mean, why does he go on and on? Why does the Buddha go on and on, listing and eliciting all the types of practices and all the realizations that come from practice? Why doesn't he just say, go off to a beautiful spot, enjoy a vacation? And I think you know why. Vacations are quite lovely. They can be restorative. But rarely is a vacation transformative. Because the truth is, even though we may get a respite, the habit forces, the strength of our internal mental formations caused from the past are very strong within us, and much more powerful than the peace an equanimity that may come to us of being in a beautiful place where we could. So knowing that, we come to a place like this, knowing that within the context of this deeply profound, peaceful, and beautiful setting, we can do the work. And we see in what we've received so far that bodhisattvas are at work. The career of working to liberate all sentient beings, that means one has to have many competencies to do a good job. And they just don't come in a flash. Right? There's nobody here who's perfected a profession, a craft, an instrument, learned a foreign language. Right? Like that. It takes what? Persistence, it takes application, it takes practice, it takes training, it takes doing. And if we, when we understand that, and I think we all do in these other contexts, we know it's really, even though some of us have more, may have more natural capacities than others, it's really a matter of the willingness to make the effort that is needed to attain it. It's really that simple. You know, I've said it before, people on other retreats, I've said it, but you know, you look at Dalai Lamas and Thich Nhat Hanhs and other great teachers, and you go, well, what's the difference between, right? Them and I, they're all born from a mother, right? They all were infants, they all were dependent little children. They all grow up, they have eyes, ears, nose, mouth, they go to the bathroom, they get sick, they age. And they will die. Right? They have eyes, they have ears, they have nose. And they, well, what's the difference between them and us? Just this. Right? That they take this seriously. This is not a hobby for them. This is not a sideline for them. Right? They fully and completely dedicate themselves to this training. And therefore they reap the rewards of it, which, as you know, greatly benefits people like us. Right. So I'm only saying that not to, not to feel, you know, people over there feeling guilty or shameful. I'm not doing it. I'm just saying, please understand that that's what this is. Right? And this is why, you know, over and over again, the teachings and the practices are shown to us. It's really our choice. If we want to develop ourselves and cultivate and be this kind of a human being that can really be a great light to other beings, then this is how we light our lamp. Right? This is how we fuel our lives. Right? If we don't, it's fine. Yeah? It's fine. But it's really as simple as that. You know, there's a great, in Milarepa, the great yogi saint of Tibet, he had a disciple, I think it was Gampopa. He had a number of disciples, but I think it was in Gampopa. A great physician. He was a doctor and became one of his disciples. And Milarepa was a yogi, and he did yogic practices, and he lived, for those who are familiar with 100,000 songs of Milarepa, he spent most of his life practice of living in retreat, and often living in retreat deep in the high in the Himalayas, doing all these kind of yogic practices, living fairly naked in practicing various kinds of significant yogic type practices. But anyhow, Gampopa, I believe it was Gampopa was with him, and had been practicing a while, and had come to good realization. And one day he comes to Milarepa and says, you know, I want to return to the valleys. You know, people are suffering there, and I think I can help them. And Milarepa, it's been a while since I read it, so forgive me, it's not so familiar. But more or less, Milarepa says to him, my son, he of course called his disciples my son or my daughter, but in this case it was my son. He said, suffering, sentient beings, yes, are suffering. Sentient beings have always been suffering. And sentient beings will probably always be suffering. There will always be sentient beings who are suffering. But my son, you have to decide. Do you want to be a little light? Right? Do you want to be a little light? Or do you want to be a great light? To guide sentient beings, right? There is darkness. There is darkness in the world of sentient beings. They suffer within, they cause suffering to each other, and they seem incapable of knowing how to stop it. So there's a darkness in the world of sentient beings. They need lights so they can see their way out. Right? So again, do you want to be a flashlight? With a flashlight, what? We can guide a few. We can provide light for a few. Or do you want to be a great light, like the sun? And so we know, some of us, in this world, there are little lights and there are great lights. Right? Some of us are little lights, we can help a few, and then there are great lights who can help tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions of people. Why is that? It is only through the commitment, the dedication of their practice. So Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, we could go on. Those are just ones that come to mind. They manifest in the world as great lights. They have the capability of moving thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Why is that? It's not because of their worldly wealth. Right? It's not because of their head of great armies or great corporations. Right? They don't have any... That's not where they get their power from, is it? It's only from the power of their practice. It is something unseen, but yet clearly seen in their action. So again, in Buddhism, it is a belief that aspiration and intention and aspiration are the nub of it, right? And if we have a great intention, and if we have a great aspiration, and if we do all the things that are needed to nurture that so it grows and manifests, it will give bear fruit. Right? So that is why, even as deluded and as self-absorbed as we are, if we can, within our consciousness, sincerely set forth the aspiration to be a Buddha, to be fully enlightened, to be fully awakened, to be fully human, and to dedicate one's life to the service, to the liberation of sentient beings, to helping them relieve their suffering, right? We will eventually, right, over time, achieve that. And we will bring a great benefit, not only to self, but to everyone. Right? All Buddhas begin just like us. Right? Don't be mistaken when you see the product.
Right.
It began just with some being hearing the teachings, reflecting on the teachings, and setting forth an aspiration. And then living, honoring that aspiration as fully as they were capable. That's all. This is not mystical, this is not esoteric, this is not metaphysical at all. It's very practical, it's very sound, it's very grounded, this path. It is replicable, you know. Something to be scientific has to be replicable. Well, we can say that this path and its realizations have been replicable for at least 2,500 years from the time of the Buddha. Because we know, you know, when we read generation after generation after generation after generation of practitioners, right? No matter where Buddhism has gone, people who have committed themselves to these practices have accomplished what was promised. Right? They have liberated themselves from their self-induced psychological suffering. They have realized their interconnection with everything. They have freed themselves of their hindrances and are able to live lives of great joy and great meaning through service to others. So that should give us heart. If we, in our own minds, may be considering a somewhat sincere and dedicated effort along these lines. You know, in Buddhism it's interesting. You know, there's really no sin in the Judeo-Christian sense. But if we were to talk of sin, the greatest sin that someone following this path can have is the sin of doubt. It's very interesting. Doubt. And what kind of doubt is it? It's the doubt of your own capacity to awaken. Doubt that what the Buddha and all the teachers have said, that we are intrinsically Buddhists, that we all have, are, always was, and will be this Buddha nature, and that it is immediately accessible to all of us. And that on the relative level, the healing and transformation of all our wounds, of all our sufferings, of all our sorrows, of all our afflictions, and our capacity to experience ourselves as totally whole human beings is within the purview and the possibility potential of all of us. To doubt that is probably your greatest hindrance. Right. We think our hindrances are our what? Our anxieties and our depressions and our egos and our, you know, all that stuff. Our childhood issues, right? We think, oh, that's what's hindering me. No. That's not what's hindering me. We all have that. That's part of what it's all about. Our greatest hindrance is our lack of faith in the possibility that we can heal and transform ourselves and become whole. That whatever wounds are deep within our psyches, whatever neurotic obsessions seem to dominate our interactions, and no matter how prevalent is our self-centeredness and egocentricity. Because inherently, nothing is permanent. And nothing is self-existent. Everything is empty of those characteristics. Therefore, it is a world that is full of potential for change and transformation. So it is important,
right,
that we reflect on this. Again, you know, Buddhism, as is taught here, is not a faith-based religion, is it? In the sense of the theistic religion that most of us are familiar with. It is really a very different, it's a path to awakening. But interestingly enough, there probably is one article of faith, right? And that is just what we talked about. And because I say faith, because that is not our experience of our essential wholeness, we have to believe, trust, in that what the Buddha reported from his own inner voyaging, what he reported as his own experience when he came to his great awakening, and as I said earlier, the continued report back from meditators and practitioners for 2,500 years, men and women, rich and poor, all different cultures and ethnic backgrounds, sizes of bodies, colors of skins, all report back the same thing. Right. So, please ponder this. Because this, having this belief, this trust, you know, in verses on the faith mind, faith is all, really it's trust. It's not the faith mind, it's the trusting mind, right? You know, at some point we have to trust, deeply trust something or someone. If we are, you know, if we are at sea, and the waves are high, and we are having trouble staying afloat, yeah. And if somebody comes along and says, what are they going to say? Either they might say, come on my boat. It doesn't leak. It'll get you where you want to go. Or somebody might come along and say, I can teach you how to swim. So you can navigate the waters yourself. But at some point, we're going to have to trust somebody because we seem to be unable to figure it out by ourselves. So it's good to find something in this life that we can trust, a way, a path that will really fulfill our deepest aspirations for our life. And again, I'm not saying that Buddhism and the Buddha is the only one. Luckily, because there are so many different types of sentient beings with so many aptitudes and so many different capacities, et cetera, et cetera, many, many forms, many, many types of boats and many types of swim strokes are available in the world. But at some point, one has to trust. Again, the Buddha said, right, don't just take what I tell you on faith, did he? who said to his disciples, you know, take it in. Chew over it. Reflect on it. Does it make sense to you? Does it seem right to you? Does it accord with your own experience? Then if it does, he says, then practice. Practice. So please go through that process with these teachings. Right? Make sure they seem right to you. Make sure they make sense to you. Make sure they seem applicable to you. Right? And if that is the case, and only then take them up and practice it. Meanwhile, back in Vaishali, we remember what? First, we're over in the in the mango grove. He's doing his magical manifestations, right? With all the parasols and everything. And then we were introduced to Vimalakirti, the master of expedient means. And now we come back to the mango grove. Okay. Chapter 3, the disciples. At that time, the rich man Vimalakirti thought to himself, it sounds a little self-pitying, I am lying here sick in bed. Why does not the world honored one, the Buddha, in his great compassion, fail to show some concern for me? It's a little bit of drama here. The Buddha, aware of this thought, said to Shariputra, you must go to visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. But Shariputra replied to the Buddha in these words, world honored one, I am not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness. Why? Because I recall one occasion in the past when I was sitting in quiet meditation under a tree in the forest. So Shariputra, just like us, right? We're sitting on a rock, we're sitting under a tree, we're sitting by a stream, right? Our minds are peaceful, we're listening to the sounds, the birds, the wind. Good meditators, good disciples of the Buddha, our minds at peace. Right? There's Shariputra. Sitting in quiet meditation under a tree in the forest. So who comes along? You know who comes along. At that time, Vimalakirti approached me and said, ah, Shariputra, you should not assume that this sort of sitting is true quiet sitting. Okay. This is very interesting what's going to happen here. I mean, again, you please understand, you know, Shariputra, the leading disciple of the Buddha, he's being, his practice is being challenged by a layman. So it's quite interesting. You should not assume that this sort of sitting is true quiet sitting. Quiet sitting means, let me just read through it and then we can discuss it. Quiet sitting means that in this threefold world, you manifest neither body nor will. This is quiet sitting. Not rising out of your samadhi at complete cessation and yet showing yourself in the ceremonies of daily life. This is quiet sitting. Not abandoning the principles of the way and yet showing yourself in the activities of a common mortal. This is quiet sitting. Your mind not fixed on internal things and yet not engaged with externals either. This is quiet sitting. Unmoved by sundry theories but practicing the 37 elements of the way. This is quiet sitting. Entering nirvana without having put an end to earthly desires. This is quiet sitting. If you can do this kind of sitting, you will merit the Buddha's seal of approval. quiet sitting. Quiet mind. Those of us who have had very active minds, those of us with lots of busyness in our minds, those of us with lots of stress and difficulty in our minds, we yearn for that, don't we? Some quiet. Right? And we yearn for that place where we can just do quiet sitting. Right? How wonderful to sit by the stream, right? Listening to birds chirping. And then along comes Vimalakirti. And he just pulls the rock. Why does he do that? Why is he disturbing poor Shariputra, who's sitting there with his mind quiet, listening to the stream, thinking, I'm following the Buddha's, I'm a good disciple of the Buddha. So this is not the first polemic against quiet sitting. If you read the Zen masters, the Chinese Zen masters, and the Japanese Zen masters, probably the Vietnamese and the Korean Zen masters, they warn their students about the devil's cave of quietude. If you read some of the ancient Lin Shi and some of the other great masters, you'll see them railing against these deadbeat Zen practitioners who think that quieting their mind and sitting peacefully is what Zen meditation is all about. Very interesting. As I said, for many of us, we would go, I don't know, that sounds pretty good. I'd settle for some of that. It is disturbing to us, isn't it? Because we would love many of us just to have a quiet mind and just be in a peaceful place. The problem with it, of course, is obvious that that type of quietude is conditional, isn't it? There's not much realization. It is really by setting up the proper circumstances, internal and external, one is at peace. But that peace is temporary, isn't it? Because it is based on situations, it's not based on understanding. This is very important. This is why, what we hear in these last, now on the fourth day, we hear over and over again, we hear, in all the teachings of the masters, right? Understanding, wisdom, know the nature of phenomena, right? Over and over again, right? Understand, the true practice of Buddhism relates to the self and understanding the nature of the self. So this is important. The peace and the tranquility that is available to us through these Dharma teachings is the peace and tranquility that comes from realization of the truth of reality. When one understands the truth of reality, when one stands on things the way they are, then we stop grasping at phenomena. Right? Then we stop making such a big deal about the drama. And we can, as Vimalakirti is saying, be in the world, be in the realm of activity, right? and have a peaceful mind. One can even have, as he says, still be involved in the realm of worldly activity and worldly desires even, right? And so be at peace. We think, what? I just got to get rid of all that, right? Then I'll be at peace. I just get all, you know, here it comes. You know, if I can just get this out of my mind, right? I'll be at peace. No. If we see the true nature of our stuff, of our issues, of our feelings, of our thoughts, of our memories, if we clearly see the true nature of them, what they really are, they will no longer be so powerful in our minds. We will no longer take them so seriously. They will no longer have the power to upset us. They will no longer have the power to inform our behavior the way they do now. Right? Why are we so controlled by our past? Because we think these things that happen to us have some kind of permanent self-existence that we have to carry with us, like they're a thing. But if we look deeply into what a feeling is, what a memory is, right, what an image is, what a thought is, look deeply, which means look deeply into our own mind, because that's where all these things are arising, right? I mean, if I said to you, this past that controls us, where is it? Where is it? But we hold on to this past, where? In our minds. Okay? It's only in our minds. It has no existence outside of our mind. Well, that's... I like that. Right? Because the past that I experienced, I didn't know that, did I? It was happening interactively, wasn't it? So therefore, it had a powerful way of affecting me, didn't it? Yeah. But at this point in time, it only exists where? In my mind. Well, I like that. I hope you like that. I like that. Because that means it only exists now as images, it only exists now as thoughts, and it only exists now in feelings that are all arising only within my own mind. And through the teachings and the practices that have been shared with me, I have learned how to deal with them. How to hold them in mindfulness and awareness. How to look deeply so I understand the causes, which takes the sting away. Right? And through the power of loving kindness and compassion, I know how to heal them, the emotional part. Right? That's wonderful to know. That's wonderful. So the practice of meditation is about this. If we find a quiet place under a tree and our minds are quiet and at peace, and there's some openness and tranquility and limpidity and clarity, use that time to look deeply into your minds, to see with clarity the source of that which causes you suffering. And use the tools of Dharma, the tools of seeing clearly, to understand the nature of this phenomena that is arising in our minds. Then we're free, and the phenomena no longer has the power to disturb us. That is the peace that Vimalakirti is encouraging Shariputra to see, right? And this is difficult, and this is unique, because there are many meditation paths that the goal is what? Flatline. Right? Flatline. In Buddhism, that flatline place is called the Devil's Cave. Very seductive, but the teachers warn about it because of everything I just said. It might be a place to rest. Isn't it nice to sit by the stream and listen to it, to hear the birds, to feel the wind, to see the moon, with an empty, limpid mind? Yeah, it's wonderful. It's one of the wonderful joys, right, of having senses and being a human being. But we're not always going to be here, are we? And so that is why the understanding of the nature of the mind and the capacity to have a profoundly open, compassionate heart is what will give us that peace that we seek. Not rising out of the samadhi of complete cessation and just showing yourself in the ceremonies of daily life. Again, he's challenging Shariputra, right? All right, you're sitting under the tree, a lot of cessation going on, empty, clear mind. Can you go through all the activities of your day with that same mind? That's quiet. When he says quiet sitting, he's really saying that's what meditation is. Right? Not abandoning the principles of the way, capital W, and yet showing yourself in the activities of a common mortal. Very beautiful, isn't it? Can in all our actions, can we be totally in accord with the way and yet totally live a natural, normal life? This reminds me of that Zen saying, you probably heard me say it before, a little saint hides themselves deep in the mountains. A great saint hides herself in the marketplace. Like that. This is why, when you read the mundos, the dialogues of the ancient masters and the collection of koan books and other things, you find them saying, what is the highest truth of Buddhism? Carrying water, chopping wood, right? Those kinds of wonderful teachings, because it's saying, how does a fully enlightened Buddha express himself? In the utter simplicity of life, right? Again, when you meet, from my experience, when you meet people of true, deep realization, where there's real integration, and that, distinctions between form and emptiness, the absolute, relative, and all that have all been done away with. You don't find otherworldly beings. Right? When you meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama, when you meet Thich Nhat Hanh, and I think when you meet other great masters, what strikes you is their utter humanity. Then what is humanity? That is the end result of all this work. Not to produce some supernatural, spiritual being. Watch out for spiritual beings, I warn you. When you see people who purport to be teachers who have the stink of spirituality about them, be careful. My experience is when you meet authentic teachers, you are struck by their authenticity, their absolute lack of any pretension. Why? Because they're free. They have no need to hold on to anything. And they are, and their realization is totally integrated into their human experience. If we meet an enlightened deer, he's not going to be carrying on like a moose. When we meet an enlightened deer, he should be a wondrous deer, right? If he's carrying on like a moose, we begin to wonder about it. When we realize our own nature, we realize it through the nature of how we have incarnated. So enlightened birds still sing. Again, I think this is a very important thing for lay people. Again, because again, as we said yesterday, because the tradition of Buddhism is expedient means upaya, which means the teachings are always appropriate and fitting for the individuals involved. You get such a diversity and almost contradictory nature in the teachings. And of course, one of the things, and this goes on. I mean, he has more encounters, and we'll get to them. But again, when you are giving practices and teachings to a renunciate, someone who has left lay life, somebody who has left householder life, somebody who has renounced, right? You know, all the things and activities of ordinary life, you give them certain teachings, right, to support them in that. Right? But when you are teaching someone who's a layperson, right, who has a home and a family and a job and has to save for their retirement and stuff, right, you give them different teachings, right, all going to the same end of realization. But different teachings. So the confusing thing is oftentimes we pick up text of Buddhist teachings, of teachings that the Buddha gave to his monk and nun, you know, his celibate disciples. And it just seems very removed from our own life. And it is. Okay? I guess what I'm getting at is when you are giving teachings to someone who has renounced the world and is living in a retreat center, living in a cave, living in a hermitage, right? Living that kind of life. Having them do practices that relate to the cessation of all thought, and the capacity to cultivate meditative trance are appropriate teachings. But for people like us, who are constantly in the world where the senses and the sense organs are constantly being stimulated, right? It's nonsense. You know, it's beyond capacity. I mean, maybe there are somebody who has that capacity, but I certainly don't. I don't know if any of you do, and I really haven't met anybody who does, right? So that kind of teaching or practice would be counterproductive to a lay person. What we need is what? We need practices and teachings that show us how to awaken, to lead an awakened life in the midst of activity. Right? Teachings that show us how to awaken in the world of non-activity, right, would not be useful to us. They would only create what in us? Frustration. Right? Disappointment. Right? And we could think that we're failures. This path is too difficult. So luckily, you know, we have this. And we have many great teachers to today who teach a lay people a path equally powerful, if not more powerful, than the renunciate path. But leads to the same capacity to have deep understanding, profound wisdom, and a loving and compassionate heart. So again, what does this come back to? It comes back to, people come and they go, well, I still have lots of thoughts, right? So therefore my practice is bad. Or I still have arisings, my stuff is still arising. Right? I still, get angry, or I still get judgmental, or, my wounded inner child, he's still doing their thing, you know what I mean? And we see that as what? Failure. Yeah, somehow, I should be beyond all that. We should understand the nature of phenomena as it arises. That's all. When the wounded child arises, we understand the nature of that. We are not disturbed in the least, are we? With the eyes of understanding, our mindfulness allows us to see what's arising. Our insight allows us to understand that, of course, it's arising, cause and condition. So there's no friction, there's no grasping, there's no drama. This is what's arising. That's all. And in my awareness, I can hold it in mindfulness. And if the response is compassion or loving kindness or whatever, I freely give it. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? If we think he or she shouldn't be there, then it becomes a big deal. Right? Some of us think, well, now that I've been practicing the Buddha's way, I should be free of anger. Right? And then what happens? We get angry, and we go, shit. As if somehow, as if practice is some kind of magical, it's like our magical childlike thinking. I'm now a Buddhist, I bow, I chant, I take in the three refuges, therefore what? I'm just one step away from full enlightenment. And all my past, all my karmic stuff, I should be free of, right? It shouldn't bother me anymore. How could it not? That's who we are. We are the product of all the causes and conditions that have created us. You don't just step away from that. And you don't want to step away from that. It's no different than we don't want to step away from the world. Right? How's the world? It's a mess. I'm sure everybody's noticed. I'm not the first one to note you know, that our world is a mess, isn't it? Right? I mean, not only are we continuing to do what human beings have always done, which is, you know, not treat each other in the kindest, most gentle, compassionate way, you know, but now we are so hell-bent on just using up all our resources, and, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, we're just out of control. Right? You know, like a food addict that just can't stop binging. And we just can't stop, you know, using up all our resources, can't stop consuming. Right? Would we love to get away from this world the way it is? Wouldn't we go to some other pure world where everybody treats one another with great kindness, gentleness? Right? There's no war, there's no violence. Right? Everybody has what they need. We treat all our natural resources with great care. Right? The birds always sing. Streams always run. I mean, right? Of course we would. But the truth is what? Because that doesn't exist, does it? And if we want that kind of world, right, we have to enter into it, don't we? To help in its transformation. In the same way, if I want, you remember that first chapter, all those qualities of Vimla Purity, all those qualities of the Bodhisattva, right? Right? Maybe you've been listening and you go, you know, to all that, those long enumerations of all those wondrous qualities that Vimla Purity had. Right? And you might say, I want all those qualities, right? Well, where do we think we're going to establish, you know, where are we going to build our house? Right in the midst of the muck of our own karmic formations. Nowhere else. It's very important that we understand that. The practice is not about creating some altered universe within ourselves. Right? You know, I'm going to create this good, dharmic, pure self over here, right? It's going to be totally different than him. Right? It's called a dissociative personality disorder. Right. This is about wholeness. This is about oneness. This about integration. Right? It's about healing and transformation. Right? You know, the lotus in the mud. Right? The lotus, that beautiful flower, grows only in muck. Right? That's the roots of the lotus. Muck. The root of all the flowers. The beautiful flowers, all in the dirt. You know the dirt? That's the stuff we're always sweeping to get out, always washing ourselves to get off, you know, right? We don't want dirt in our house, right? We don't want dirt on ourselves, right? Parents are always telling us, you're dirty, go clean up. Right? And yet, flowers only grow in the dirt. Well, I guess hydroponically, you know. But anyhow, traditionally. Flowers only grow in the dirt, right? That's right, we have some compost makers here. What do you use for your compost?
Garbage.
What?
Garbage.
Garbage. Garbage, garbage, garbage. Stuff that other people cast away. Thich Nhat Hanh, as you know, uses that beautiful analogy. you're all familiar with it, I mean, where he says, you know, if we leave it just to be garbage, it what? It rots. It rots. But someone who knows how to make compost can take other people's garbage, right, and mix it a certain way and turn it into something way, and, right? And over time, it becomes what? Yeah, a rich medium for vegetables, for flowers, right? It's compost. And so it's a beautiful analogy. You say, well, that's what practice is about, right? We're not throwing out the garbage, right? We'd like to throw the garbage out, wouldn't we? Right? And start out fresh, a new Dharma self, totally reinvented. It doesn't work that way. There are many practitioners who do that. They repress their old self, they deny their old self, they pretend that they're a different person now since they were following a spiritual path. Right? And they erect this new dharmic, meditational, metaphysical, spiritual personality on the garbage of the old. Right? But what happens with garbage? It stinks. And eventually, the stink is going to start coming up. It's nice to project that it's out there. But if we follow our nose carefully, we'll say what? My very own stinking garbage. We cannot create a wall thick enough that will prevent our garbage from rotting and affecting us with its stink. So better to what? To learn to work skillfully. This is the practice. This is why this paragraph here is so important. Forgive me for once again not moving forward, but I think this is such a key point of practice that Vimalakirti is doing. He's telling us we need to see our meditation practice not as gaining some sort of quiescent state. Right? And again, I am saying to all of us, it is seductive, right? I can understand it. But it is just a stopping place along the way. It is not the realization that this path offers us. This is a key point of Dharma. It is through understanding the nature of phenomena and learning not to grasp at phenomena, because one understands the nature of it, that one develops the capacity to be at peace, to be calm in the midst of all the arisings and passings. Is that clear? I mean, this is an important piece of Dharma. And again, there are many practices, many traditions where the goal is this quiescence, this quietude. And I'm not, again, I'm not, you know what I'm saying? It's not like, it's not like I go, smoky mountains, you know. I mean, come on, I've been to the Himalayas. I mean, what's this, this is nothing, right? You see what I'm saying? It's not like that. It's not like saying, mental cessation and quietude, right, is terrible. You see what I'm saying? Right? I mean, one can enjoy the smokies. They're quite beautiful, aren't they? You know, one's always comparing. But all I'm saying is there is a vaster view. There is a vaster. And there is a difference between being on the top of a 4,000 foot mountain and between being on the top of a 14,000 foot mountain. The view is different. The topography is different. That's all. And it's really, again, for each of us, you know, to decide, you know, what view do I want? Again, the problem with the mental quietude practice, again, is it's situational. And again, now we understand why so many meditators still have a lot of difficulty with their daily life, still have a lot of difficulty with their relationships. Because they just see their practice as just quieting their mind. Right? If I can just get this goddamn one point. Forgive me. I don't mean to offend anybody. But I mean, you know what I mean? It's that kind of. Then everything will be all right. You know, to always kind of right, running back to the mat, trying to quiet this damn thing. Again, the problem. So again, the problem is not simply that we have an out-of-control mind. The problem is what? That we follow it around. Stop following it around. If it wants to run here, it wants to run there, if you can just watch it. There's the equanimity. There's the quiet. There's the stability. If you can watch it, if you can see its nature, and if you can just let it unfold in the arisings and passings, as is the nature. In that moment, you are liberated from suffering. You don't have to destroy it. You don't have to get rid of it. But you have to learn to be skillful in the way you deal with the phenomena of your minds. So that's what we're doing here in retreat, by the way. Because you might have noticed what? That whether you're sitting or standing or walking or lying, phenomena is what? Constantly arising and passing away, right? How many thoughts have you had since you've been here? This is day four. How many thoughts have you had? How many mind states have you had? How many emotional states? How many things have you seen? How many sounds have you heard, right? How many things have you felt? How many things have you tasted? How many smells have you smelled, right? How many? You can't even begin. Now what if all those arisings and passings, you were just able to be present to allow it to enter through our mindfulness, to not grasp, did not follow, did not link things up, and just allow them to come and go as they will. And if something needed a little more attention, we even gave it. If something got a little sticky, we just did a little uncoupling. A little care here, a little tenderness there, a little letting go there. All very gentle. Not a big deal. That kind of practice you can take back with you when you go home, can't you?
You see what I mean?
You can take that kind of practice home. But a practice that is so totally based on the cessation of thought and having mental tranquility, conducive based on a beautiful surroundings and the sound of a stream, when you don't have those conditions, your old conditions are just going to take over again. So that is why I say to you, as lay people, right? Now, I mean, you know, Carol's here, and she's in Southern Dharma, so she lives here. So we give her different teachings. But for those of us who are only here for 7 days, right, it's very we have to kind of use this time in the way it'll be most beneficial for the totality of our lives. Right. So, Carrie, you have a question? Yes.
So, why focus on the breath and meditation? Why not just focus on the same sentence or whatever arises?
Right. Because until we have some stability and groundedness, right, most of us, the arisings, we still get immediately swept away because of habit force. Okay? So traditionally, the practice begins with establishing mindfulness and concentration. Okay? So there's a ground. So there's some grounding upon which one can then do the observing. You see, that's why this is quote unquote a higher practice. Okay, again, you know, if you learn the piano, you start with scales, right? Simple exercise. So you just kind of, you know, learn the keyboard, learn to hit the right notes, right? Kind of, you know, develop some flexibility and dexterity in the hands, right? Before you start playing pieces of any complexity. So it's like that. I mean, the capacity to be mindful, you know. To be mindful means what? At least I see what is going on in front of me. I smell what my nose is smelling, I hear what my ears are hearing, I see what my eyes are hearing, and I know when thoughts and feelings and perceptions are arising. Okay? Now I'm in the ballpark at least. Right? Concentration, which means learning to keep the mind single-mindedly on somewhere, develops greater stability, right, and greater capacity, right, to have control over one's mind. Okay. So when you get to that third level where you're developing the capacity to observe, right, there is some strength to your mind. Does that make sense? So it's just like if you never exercise in your life and you never weight trained and you start going to the gym, the trainer probably wouldn't put you right away on the highest weights and the most, right? They kind of, you understand. So it's like that. Okay. So again, that's why, some people, you meet them and say, well, I practice, choiceless awareness. Bum, ba, bum. these are very hard practices, right? You know, that one has to have some groundedness and some stability and some significant passive strength in one's mind to, right, to be able to just rest in awareness and just to have all the phenomena rise without any grasping, without any storytelling, without any embroidery, without any linking. I mean, is that easy? No. Yes. So it is these other meditative practices that are giving us the capacity that when we do these practices. Traditionally, it's different these days because traditionally, as I said to you, most of these practices were done quite often in retreat, right? So you would do your mindfulness for a year or two. You would do your concentration for a couple of years. You see what I'm saying? You'd be building up. But as lay people, because of the nature of the activity of our life, because this is a very different community, the teachings are being given simultaneously. So that is why often one might be simultaneously, doing these practices. in the same way one does a practice session on the piano. Right? One might, let's say if one's doing a half hour, 40 minute meditation, first 5 or 10 minutes, one may be stabilizing the mind or something through various practices, but then one would be concentrating the mind, the last 10 minutes, you know, just watching the mind. So it's one of the developing these capacities all the time, because most of us don't live in retreat situations. But on the other hand, you know, to go on a retreat where you're just focusing on mindfulness, to go on a retreat where you're just focusing on single point of concentration, to go on a retreat where you're just focusing on insight, right? In a more concentrated way, are also very helpful and useful for building up that strength of mind. I'm sorry, did that answer your... Yeah, okay. Yes.
In my own history, I feel like forever in my spiritual path, I had this notion that there was some mind state to be achieved.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down that path. And then I moved to California, and I went through this path of psychotherapy and self-exploration, and mm-hmm. what I found was like all this deep inner anger and resentment from having never expressed my emotion.
Right.
So then I started trying to express all my emotions. You know, I'm looking for something in the middle.
Yeah.
And regardless of that, you know, we're talking about it in a personal dynamic. I found that, you know, to be authentic might mean hurting people sometimes or offending them. And I'm wondering, is that compassionate?
Yeah.
And, you know, where are these guidelines for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd love to have really set guidelines for them. Yeah, so in answer to your first question, you know, it's, you know, the teachings are kind of generic, right? And yet we see that the expediency or the skillful application of them is what's important. So that's why, you know, it's important in the same way in psychotherapy. You know, very dangerous to be your own psychotherapist, and it's hard to be objective. It's good to find a good therapist to work with, right? So in the same way, in terms of Dharma, it's good to have a teacher, someone to work with, who can take the generic teachings and practices and apply them specifically, you know, to your own development. But again, I think, you know, I think you're on the right path, in the sense of understanding that there is a middle way, right? That there is a way to be authentically Scott, right? And at the same time to have enough kind of boundaries and parameters that he doesn't just run amok in his own self-absorbed world, right? And to find that balance is good. To do no harm, ahimsa, is the first of the five mindfulness trainings, the five precepts, and one of the basis of the Buddhist teachings. Do no harm, nonviolence. Again, nonviolence is not a thing. Right? It's something living and dynamic, right? Which means in every situation, you just do your best to do no harm. But, you know, it's impossible, right? Not just being human. I could say, you know, I don't want to kill anything, right? So there's some things I can do. I can be a vegetarian, so I don't, so there's no animal dying. But, you know, I walk around and inadvertently I step on things, or, and it's hard not to kill. As well as, even though I try to, you know, myself not be involved in killing, I pay taxes that support killing in the world. And that's the truth. So, you know, none of us have clean hands. Right? If some, young woman came to you and said, I love you, Scott. Please spend the rest of your life with me. Right? And if you didn't love her, you wanted her, and you said no to her, right? that would hurt her, wouldn't it? There's no getting away from that. If you said yes, and it was inauthentic, then you would, in the long run, be hurting both her and you. So sometimes, that's just the way it is. You know, and to, it's important that at the same time that we live in the world, trying to do as little harm for ourselves, but we understand that there's no getting away from it. Right? It's the nature of things, right? Do people ever disappoint you? Yeah. And so you, in turn, will maybe disappoint others. That's just life. Has anyone ever hurt you? Yes. Has anyone ever rejected you? Yes. Might you do that to someone else? Yes. You know, it's only our egocentricity that thinks, oh, it shouldn't be that way. Is that clear? So, you know, to me, the guideline is always to be as authentic as I can and to do the least harm, which means I understand that I may be saying something or doing something that may hurt or disappoint another. So let me do it as carefully as I can, with full acknowledgement of that and expressing. There's nothing wrong with expressing to somebody, you know, I'm sorry, because what I'm going to say or do, I know is going to disappoint you. And I wish it could be another one. It can't be for me at this moment. So again, one can act, you know, one can kill a cockroach. I live in Florida. the cockroaches are a constant presence. I can kill a cockroach and I can feel bad about it. I can go like that and say, I'm sorry. I mean, I understand that from the cockroach's point of view, that's... you know, I understand that. But it just, for me... At least in my own egocentricity and wanting to have a house not filled with overrun with cockroaches, that when I do have to take life, at least I do it with some regret, some acknowledgement that I am taking a life. And even though that cockroach or that ant or that bug or that mosquito may be insignificant in the greater scheme of things. Yet, to that individual mosquito and cockroach or whatever, it's their life. So it is significant to them. So, you know. So one can live with that kind of acknowledgement, even when one participates in that part of life. It's part of life. And also, part of life is coming to an end. So, thank you. We will continue tomorrow with the accounts of the disciples and the bodhisattvas, and then we will then move on.